So you've got a business, but what about a brand? The difference? More of you. Wix gives you the freedom to create your website, own your brand, and do it on your own, exactly how you envisioned it. Experience limitless customization. Boost your creativity and efficiency with AI tools for every part of your business journey. Scale up with built-in SEO, e-com, and scheduling features. Put more of you in your business. Go to Wix.com and do it all yourself.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour as we look at some of the big stories making the news in business and politics here in Ireland and all around the world. Coming up on today's show, it's happening. We've got a new government in place here in Ireland and Trump 2.0 has begun. Among the executive orders he swiftly passed was the Global Tax Pact withdrawal. That's the one that deals with global corporation tax. But what does it mean for Ireland? Well, Thomas Huber, who is the editor of The Currency, and he's going to be joining me later to discuss. But it wasn't all tax.
The inflation crisis was caused by massive overspending and escalating energy prices. And that is why today I will also declare a national energy emergency. We will drill, baby, drill.
Yes, drill, baby, drill. But what exactly does that mean and what could it mean for Ireland? Well, Jamie Smith from the Financial Times in Washington will be joining us later on that. And like some mega wealth watch party on the ski slopes in Switzerland, the great and the good looked on and held their breath. What was it like at Davos this week? We get all the gossip from Leila De Cresta, who's the global breaking news editor at Reuters. That's all coming up on the show. And if you want to contact us about anything, you can email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. And we're also open on X at StockNT. Now, for our first item today, we're turning to Davos because the 55th annual meeting of the World Economic Forum has been taking place there all this week. And joining me now to discuss some of the main areas that the global leaders were looking at all this week is Leila De Cresta. She is the global breaking news editor at Reuters. Leila, you did this for us last year and you're very welcome back to us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, just remind us all what Davos is supposed to be and give us a flavour of what the mood music was like going into this week.
I mean, the idea of the World Economic Forum meeting is to gather world leaders, business leaders, and people who want to change the world and hold a week-long conference where they try to do that. They hold a bunch of sessions where you can learn about new things, debate issues. But the truth is there's only one man whose presence has been felt at this Davos, and that's obviously the new US President Donald Trump. And actually, he's speaking right now through, although virtually, to a packed Congress while we're hosting this. So it's actually very quiet for the first time around me right now, Mandy, because almost anyone who's anyone at Davos is in that hall right now watching this live speech.
Well, we really appreciate you stepping out and taking the time to talk to us about it. Maybe just to give us a flavour of who actually was on the ground there this week. You know, a lot of world leaders descending on Davos, but maybe this year it was, you know, more about who wasn't there. Donald Trump, obviously, at his inauguration. But what about the other world leaders?
So we didn't see President Xi from China, and obviously Keir Starmer wasn't there either from the UK, but Rachel Reeves was, and she, the Chancellor, was here trying to sell the UK to investors. We saw a lot of African leaders. South Africa's Cyril Ramaphosa was here. We just met with the Botswanan president, newly elected president, actually, and it's some very interesting people. So it was a mix. We definitely, European Commissioner Ursula von der Leyen was here. We saw Christine Lagarde. There is definitely a mix of leaders from different parts of the world. But it's always the case at Davos that deals get struck, and those leaders, you know, especially from Europe, have a real need to kind of go and spook their countries right now to kind of attract investment, especially while the new US president kind of is trying to juice the roaring US economy.
Mm. What was Monday like there when Trump was actually making his series of inauguration speeches? Did they gather in big bunches? Was there a kind of cinema hall where they watched it? What was that like?
Yeah, so they actually streamed it here at the WEF, and there were people watching. You could watch it on screens, and you could see people kind of crowd around TVs or screen watching. But where it was really interesting was also like some of the restaurants had TVs and parties. Like Davos's parties don't usually get going till the Tuesday and the Wednesday, so a few of them started earlier on Monday night. And also they love a late night drink where you could see people kind of with a glass of wine and just kind of watching what was going on, because he was obviously taking the oath about 6 p.m. our time.
And what were the main takeaways from his speech that night that they were concerned about over there?
So I would say one of the biggest takeaways from what he's done with executive orders is what he's done on DEI, diversity, equity and inclusion. And that's kind of reverberated quite loudly through the halls here. So one of the things about the World Economic Forum is it really does have clear goals about increasing representation for underrepresented, closing the gender gap. These are things that are kind of at the top of the list of priorities. And Trump, you know, has made it clear he wants to punish private businesses who do have DEI programs. So we heard a lot from executives that we spoke to about this. Some are welcoming it. Others, though, have said that what they don't think that they'll be getting rid of diversity programs overnight. What they think is that maybe there'll be new words used to describe these initiatives. And it's been interesting. Like, on both the left and the right, there is some degree of feeling that the names and the words were failing us, that by labelling something DEI, it was stopping a conversation that needed to happen. That said, you know, we haven't got gender parity in anywhere in the world, not one single country. So sometimes these words don't necessarily turn into action.
Yeah, one of the people actually just picking up on that point who did mention this specifically, I think it was the CEO of Bank of America. And he said that Trump's policy in this regard was going to be good for business. Like, what did he mean by that? Because as you said, this is something that most businesses have been heavily trying to take as part of their corporate business plan. So what was he talking about there?
I think there is a group of people who believe that you could drive diversity by making it less tick the box, right? There are also others that I've heard this being spoken about a lot here, that if you take a bottom up approach rather than a top down approach, you might drive a more frank and meaningful change in the workplace than what's happening sometimes in corporations where diversity is in name only. And I think that is what some business leaders are pushing at the moment. But again, you know, we always have to be skeptics about this. And I think it remains to be seen what happens. It is a real fear, though, for some businesses, and we spoke to them, if they have US contracts, you know, he's making it difficult for them to have DEI programs. And so we're going to have to see how that shakes out.
Absolutely. Now, the other thing that he stepped back from, which kind of caused some gasps where I was, that they were walking away from the Green Deal. And it kind of led me to thinking about Ursula von der Leyen's statement in the summertime, where they themselves had moved a little bit from climate and more towards competitiveness. So can you just talk me through what the reaction to that was there? Maybe no surprise.
Well, I mean, I think many people had expected Trump to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. He also withdrew from the WHO. And it's really interesting. I mean, that means the US will not be providing financing for a number of climate initiatives. And the US is obviously one of the biggest providers of cash in these regards. And we know climate financing is already well behind where it needs to be. So I think the big question here is who steps up, right? Mm. European economies are under a lot of pressure. But I think it'd be interesting to watch what the billionaires do, right? This has been a hot topic for them when they had governments that were supportive of climate financing. What do they do when they have Trump who is not as supportive? So I think that's something that we have to watch and see how it shakes out.
Yeah, one of the big names that did attend was Ursula von der Leyen. And I guess you're getting a sense that this US-EU potential trade war is something that's, look, it's high in the minds of politicians here in Ireland, and I'm guessing it's the same right across all the member states in Europe. But do you think that they're presenting a united front and that they're prepared to be aligned on the challenges that Trump might introduce in terms of tariffs or even the changes that he'll make on corporation tax? We saw him stepping back again from that OECD tax act.
So it's interesting you say that. I was in the room when von der Leyen gave her address here. And, you know, she was conciliatory towards Trump. She was very much signalling that she that Europe was ready to do business with him. But European growth and sort of kickstarting that is an issue. And also, I guess one of the perceptions we're getting, you know, especially with everything going on in Ukraine, is each European, one of the major European countries, seem to have their own political situations internally that just seem to make that very hard. So I do think that kind of fractured Europe concept definitely has come across here at WEF, and how that might actually be beginning to affect the Europeans' ability to kickstart their own growth. There was a lot of talk, though, about countries meeting with big tech, meeting with investors to try to, and that they're very attracted to Europe. Let's see if that actually turns out.
Yeah, the conference theme, I think, was collaboration for the intelligent age. So I'm taking from that AI was a big part of this week's discussions. How did that feature?
It did, although not as loudly as we thought. I mean, Trump kind of takes the wind out of the AI sails a little bit. I will say that, you know, obviously everybody, a lot of the companies here that were kind of pushing their new technology were definitely AI. One way it did come up was when it comes to nuclear. We know that AI requires enormous amounts of power, and we're hearing from, you know, every country in the world about sort of a move towards nuclear energy. And so that was an interesting discussion that was happening about Davos from different places. And you know, it puts the burden on a shift again away from renewables maybe, but we heard a lot about the sort of energy requirements that will be needed to power the next phase of AI.
Leah, we're always fascinated to find out what's happening in the background with the parties and the celebrities. We saw the tech bros in the front row of Trump's inauguration. Were there any kind of famous names who popped up this year?
So David Beckham was a Crystal Award winner. So that was definitely one of the more famous names. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. This is the thing. I wish I could go to Davos and meet like famous celebrities instead of economists and business leaders. But I will say that Beckham received an award, and so he was probably the most famous celebrity that came this time around.
Mm. Some people, when we're talking about Davos, there's an inevitable criticism that turns towards the event itself about elitism. It's out of touch. And even on those climate claims that it's just really, you know, billionaires arriving en masse and chewing up their own carbon credits. Like, is there any sense of that this is potentially something that's on the wane? And we see lots of world leaders did not attend this year.
So it's hard to tell. You know, this concept of withered Davos comes up every year. I will say that I think timing was probably the biggest reason that there may have been less participation. The inauguration, obviously, of Trump really required leaders to come to the US. And I think that we had heard reports that he was considering coming. Mm. So I think we have to wait and see. On the elitism thing versus the populace, I mean, there are those that argue that you must have people who are leading the world be in rooms with each other and talk about what they can do to improve the world. And I definitely believe that. But I do think, you know, we are living in a more and more fragmented society. And as we see populist movements, it's really important for governments to feel like they're involving their people as well. So we've had plenty of populists here, though, at Davos. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Leela, there's no shortage of populists anywhere in the world at the moment right now. Leela, we really do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us again. And that was Leela de Cresta, Global Breaking News Editor at Reuters. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Next, more on Trump. This time it's energy. Join us after the show.
So you've got a business, but what about a brand? The difference? More of you. Wix gives you the freedom to create your website, own your brand, and do it on your own, exactly how you envisioned it. Experience limitless customization. Boost your creativity and efficiency with AI tools for every part of your business journey. Scale up with built-in SEO, e-com, and scheduling features. Put more of you in your business. Go to Wix.com and do it all yourself.
Cats have always acted like they're don't stink. Now with Fresh Step Heavy Duty's new 30-day odor control, it actually doesn't. Fresh Step's new heavy-duty litter fights odor three times longer than the leading brand. This is Fresh Step's strongest litter ever, giving your litter box 30 days of odor control. Step it up to Fresh Step with the new heavy-duty litter. Three times claim based on fecal malodor versus the leading regular clumping litter. Strongest litter ever is based on odor control. Febreze is used under license from the Procter & Gamble Company or its affiliates.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain, and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
Break. You welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, there were two emergencies declared by President Trump this week. One was immigration and the other was energy. In the president's own words, the message is drill, baby, drill. But is this actually a departure or just more of the same? And what effect will it have on the US and indeed world energy prices? And what does it mean for your energy bills? Well, I'm delighted to be joined by Jamie Smith from the Financial Times. He's based in New York. Jamie, thanks very much for joining us again today.
Great to be here, Mandy.
Now, Jamie, sometimes when you hear energy and macroeconomic energy, people tend to switch off. But this is something that could have a real effect on people's pockets. And we'll get to that in a moment. But I want to start off by looking at the difference between what Donald Trump is proposing and what Biden was doing. So what was Biden's energy policy?
Well, yeah, we're seeing a complete change of energy policy over the last couple of days, because President Biden's, his policy was based around boosting renewables, trying to incentivize the energy transition in the US. So he put a lot of money into wind, solar, nuclear, other forms of energy. Now, ironically, he didn't talk a lot about oil and gas, but actually oil and gas did increase in terms of production in the US to record levels during his time in office. Now, the main reason for that was because whenever Russia invaded Ukraine, sparking a massive energy crisis in Europe and across the world, well, basically, the prices went through the roof and US producers responded to that by investing heavily. So at the minute in the US, you've got record production. 21 million barrels of petroleum products are made every year here. That's more than anywhere else in the world. And the US has been the biggest crude oil producer for the last 6 years. It's all really down to this shale revolution here. You know, this technology called fracking that enables oil producers to extract oil and gas from rock. That's really transformed the US into this biggest oil and gas producer in the world. So that's the current state of play. And that's the situation as Donald Trump enters office.
And what did Donald Trump do and say? And what is he changing? What does he want to do?
So Trump is very much in bed with the oil and gas producers. There was a famous meeting in Mar-a-Lago in April before the election where he invited them all to dinner and requested donations and said, if I get into office, I'm going to remove a lot of these environmental impediments and help you boost production. And his mantra is drill, baby, drill. And on his first day in office, he published a blizzard of executive orders, which are really seeking to boost oil and gas production. He wants to put energy at the center of US national security, and he wants to repeal all these environmental rules that restrict oil and gas industry. And he also sort of shifted a lot of funding away from renewables and is going to incentivize fossil fuel production. So the scope of these orders was really quite impressive.
Yeah. Now, you just mentioned there he withdrew some of the funding from renewables. Talk to me a little bit about what that looks like. What are the big projects that might be affected by this? Because I'm presuming, you know, this energy industry is a multi-billion dollar industry and it's a long one. So it requires political stability, lots of money, long-term thinking. What projects might be in jeopardy because of this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, all energy companies need stability over the long term to actually invest in products. And the Biden administration had passed the various acts, the Inflation Reduction Act and bipartisan infrastructure law. They were really offering hundreds of billions of dollars of loans, grants and other incentives to try and get companies to build out their energy infrastructure. And it was very much tilted towards the renewables sector and green energy. Mm. Now, Trump came in and what he did was he has ordered a review of that and he's frozen it basically. And, you know, we worked out that up to $300 billion of funding is at risk in the coming years. And the types of projects, you know, some very important projects, there's a lot of utilities here that are trying to build up their transmission infrastructure to meet what people are calling is an electricity crisis in the US. Now, I wouldn't say it's a crisis, but what we're seeing is for the first time after 20 years of flat growth, there is a big jump in electricity demand here. And that's because you've got all these AI data centers building out. Mm. So there is a need to get more electricity infrastructure and transmission infrastructure built out. So there were two companies who were offered, I think it was $11 billion, more than $11 billion in guaranteed loan guarantees. And those two projects have not been finalized, so they're frozen. So that's just, you know, two examples. But there's literally hundreds of projects out there where people are now looking and saying, you know, are we going to get the federal money? What does it mean? Can investors have the confidence to go ahead? I mean, one of the worst affected sectors is the wind sector. Mm. So offshore wind, basically, Trump has put a moratorium on all new approvals there. So there's not going to be any new offshore wind projects approved during the next 4 years. And even onshore wind, which is really key, actually, to boosting, you know, generation capacity in the US, that's also been put under review. So, yeah, it's a very negative signal for the renewable sector.
And it's such a volte-face, really, isn't it, from where we were even 5 years ago when, you know, you'd see the oil and gas production cancelled, not the renewable energy side of things. But this is undoubtedly the direction he's going to go. Just before we leave the renewable side, even the contracts, Jamie, that might be underway already, do you think they're not safe either?
It's hard to say what is safe and what isn't at the minute, because we've just had these executive orders. Mm. I mean, my feeling is that if you've got the money already, you're fine. Mm. If you've got the money in train, you might get it, but you might not. Because what's going to happen is we're going to have a load of legal claims and legal actions. And actually, some of this money that was provided by the Biden administration is protected by, because it's a legislative act of Congress. So there's a big question about whether Trump has the legal powers to rescind all this money. And you can expect a lot of people going to court to try and get the incentives back.
Yeah, and that's an industry that can lawyer up very quickly. It's not, it has deep pockets itself. Jamie, you mentioned fracking, and the ambition of Donald Trump in this is for the US to not just fulfill their own energy requirements through indigenous domestic product, but also export. So LNG is one of the big exporting energies that they have, and even something that has been talked about by Ursula von der Leyen at European level, as this is something maybe that Europe could look to in terms of that transactional nature of Donald Trump. Is that the road he's going down, and do you see Europe responding on that one?
He definitely wants to export more LNG, and he wants to boost production at home as well. And build out gas generators across the US to try and sort of help get this AI revolution and AI data centers built out. So the thing about American oil and gas production is it is really at record level. Mm. You know, it's grown, it's the biggest in the world. And actually the companies themselves are not showing any desire to boost production further. In fact, you know, global demand for oil is weakening at the minute. So it's increasing slowly and much slower than it has before. And that's really due to, you know, China's economy is quite weak at the minute. And it's actually undergoing an energy transition with a very fast take up of electric vehicles. So there's not a lot of increased demand for oil production. So producers are seeing that and they're saying, well, why would we boost production if we're not going to make a lot of money? Mm. And
That could have a lot to do with the fact that governments all over the world have, through ESG targets, incentivized business to pivot towards them. So, you know, I don't think that that's going to move or change in the short term. But can I ask you, Jamie, about what all of this does, all this speculation does to the share price and to the price of a product like that we might be filling up our cars with or being charged for our electricity? Because Ireland is still one of the highest electricity prices in Europe. What does this type of volatility and speculation do to share prices?
Well, funnily enough, whenever Trump says, drill, baby, drill, we're going to boost production, It's actually put a lid and pushed down the oil price somewhat, and LNG prices can be linked to that. So that's probably actually helping to reduce prices somewhat. But I think you've got to look at another element of Trump's economic policy, and that is tariffs. And if he goes ahead with threatened tariffs on the EU and China and Canada and Mexico, that could have quite a devastating effect on the world economy. And that could lead to inflation, that could push up prices even further. So, you know, in theory, Trump's idea of boosting LNG exports, boosting oil production could bring prices down somewhat. Mm-hmm. But then I think the other elements of his program would be very, very worrying to Ireland, the EU, and a lot of other governments around the world.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that a little bit later on. The other thing that you mentioned briefly earlier was the statements he made in relation to electric vehicles. Can you maybe take us through that and explain what you think his rationale is? Because I guess that his best buddy Elon is not too happy with this.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, this, because, you know, the oil lobby has been very focused on what they call the electrical electric vehicle mandates in the US. Now, they're not really mandates, but the Biden administration had put tougher restrictions on tailpipe emissions, and that's to try and encourage people to switch towards electric vehicles. They've also got a $7,500 tax break for each person who buys an electric vehicle. And some states like California had actually put down, you know, really targets for getting rid of combustion vehicles off the streets as they push towards EVs. So Trump's really trying to, I suppose, you know, his big supporters in the oil industry want that slowed down, and he's gone ahead and he's issued various decrees to do that. Yet he is actually very close to Elon Musk, who is, you know, is the majority owner of Tesla, and the richest man in the world. And obviously you would think he would have the interest in protecting EV sales. But actually, some of these actions from Trump are probably going to hurt smaller EV companies and new entrants rather than Tesla, which has quite a strong market share. So there could be method in the madness there in respect that actually Tesla will continue to grow and it won't face as tough competition from rivals who aren't as well established. Mm. So that is one of, so analysts say that could be part of that, you know.
And Jamie, just stepping back from the energy stuff for a moment, how did this all go down in New York? I was there for the first time that Trump came into office, and there was a real kind of sense of fracturedness between him and the people of New York. How are they treating his second coming?
Well, I mean, it's I think there's quite a lot of resignation almost, you know, whereas the first time around when Trump was, you know, took office, there were a lot of protests and there was a lot of pushback and a lot of activism, you know. This time around, there does seem to be a little bit more of a resignation. Maybe it's because he won the popular vote this time. He got a lot more seats. He's got Congress. So I think there's not quite as much opposition, and that will be interesting to see if he can actually implement a lot of his mandate and his program. I think that would be one of the concerns for Democrats, you know, who don't, I think, are in a bit of disarray themselves.
Yeah, it certainly seems they have a big job of work to do. Jamie, listen, thank you so much for taking the time to take us through all of that today. That was Jamie Smith from the Financial Times. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. After the break, Thomas Hooper, editor of The Currency, talks to us about the Global Tax Pact.
You know where your business would be without you. Imagine where it could go with more of you. Well, with Wix, you can create a website with more of your vision, your voice, your expertise. Wix gives you the freedom to truly own your brand and do it on your own, with full customization and advanced AI tools that help turn your ideas into reality. Scale up without being held back by cookie-cutter solutions and grow your business into your online brand. Because without you, your business is just business as usual. Take control. Go to Wix.com.
Cats have always acted like they don't stink. Now with Fresh Step Heavy Duty's new 30-day odor control, it actually doesn't. Fresh Step's new heavy-duty litter fights odor three times longer than the leading brand. This is Fresh Step's strongest litter ever, giving your litter box 30 days of odor control. Step it up to Fresh Step with the new heavy-duty litter. Three times claim based on fecal malodor versus the leading regular clumping litter. Strongest litter ever is based on odor control. Febreze is used under license from the Procter & Gamble Company or its affiliates.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, newly minted US President Donald Trump has moved to pull the United States out of a landmark global tax deal, setting up a potential standoff between his administration and the European Union. And it's something he's been talking about at Davos this week. Well, joining me now to read the tea leaves is Thomas Huber, who's the editor with The Currency. Thomas, you're very welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Mandy.
Thomas, we get to the OECD stuff and how that might affect us here in Ireland, potentially in the future. But maybe just give us your take on Donald Trump's first few days, the inauguration, the tone setting, and what he might have said at Davos this week.
Yeah, it's very much reading the tea leaves, as you said. There's a kind of flurry of activity, a lot of executive orders on the first day, then more in that speech on Thursday addressing Davos from Washington by video. And a lot of different directions. Basically, a lot of it is domestic focused and wouldn't really affect the rest of the world directly. It's all about immigration and hiring freezes, the regulation of business inside the US. It's very interesting if you're living and working there, if you're investing there as well, maybe from Ireland, not so much of impact on transatlantic relations. Then there's all the commercial stuff, the trade, the tariffs, the tax, and how multinationals are affected by that. That's where it gets a lot more interesting for us. It's a lot of threats at the moment of, if you do this, if you don't do this, you're going to suffer. If you do this for me, I'm going to look after you. That's the general tone. Nothing immediate. No measures such as tariffs on the first day, as some people were expected, as he had said himself, would happen. And instead, a lot of things in the balance, and very much the message, it's up to you, the rest of the world, to do deals with me and escape all those things I have in store for you.
Yeah, a more insidious threat really hanging over you, but no action as such. Just on the OECD issue and the global tax deal that he stepped back from, before we talk about what he did, maybe it's worth just going back to what we did and explaining the pressure that we've always been under, even from the EU, about our corporation tax. But take us through that and maybe what happened to change the Irish position in recent years.
Yeah, the OECD, it's not even the OECD itself. It's the OECD was the forum and the sponsor of that deal, but it's really nearly all the countries in the world coming together saying multinationals are not paying enough tax, because if I tax you, they go to the next country next door and they get a better deal. And it's the race to the bottom. So everybody agreed to at least have a floor. And that came to 15% minimum corporation tax. Everybody signed up to that in principle. And then there's a long road to implementation. And Ireland was one of the latest countries, the last countries to join the agreement in principle, to say, OK, we'll raise our corporation tax rate from 12.5% to 15% for those multinationals specifically. Mm-hmm. And that was part of an EU directive. So everybody in Europe is doing it. But not only Europe, all the big markets in the world, from Australia to Japan to non-EU members in Europe, such as Switzerland, have joined, and then developing countries as well. So there was this kind of level playing field that was agreed 2021. Mm. And the US signed up to it in principle at the executive level under President Biden, but didn't actually implement it.
Yeah,
and that's where we are when Trump comes in.
Yeah, and that's, I suppose, interesting, because on the one hand, it looks like this is a huge departure. He stepped away from it, but Biden actually hadn't done anything to enact it. Was there a reason for that, or was it politics at play between the Democrats and the Republicans? Why didn't he do something?
It was partly a partisan issue, and it was partly a kind of presidency, White House versus Congress issue. So like the administration around Biden was very much up for it. They signed up to the deal and then they came back to Washington and Congress. Mm. There was no way it was going to go through, partly because they didn't have a full majority, and the Senate, you know, you need to work across the aisle to get something through that. But even some Democrats weren't happy that this was agreed without them back in Washington.
Yeah, I'm interested to get your perspective on why he did this, because in his first term, Donald Trump, I think, changed the corporation tax from 35 to 21%. And there was a thought that he would now change it from 21% down to 15%. And this would have been helpful to him to do that. So what do you think this is about for him? Is it about the next element of what's in the pact? Or what do you think his motivation for this is?
The whole thing around the 15% is that what Trump actually said to the assembled CEOs and leaders in Davos was, if you come to make stuff in America, I'm going to give you a very good tax rate at 15%, which is the figure that's been discussed. It's not set in stone, but the idea is that if you make stuff in America, you would get that tax break. But he also said in the same breath, if you want to make stuff outside the US and ship it over here, he said, as is your prerogative, I'm not forcing you to do anything, but then there will be tariffs. Mm. And that's the carrot and stick. So carrot, come to the US, make stuff there, build factories there, and you're getting as low a rate as in Ireland, and that's competition. Don't, like, if you don't do it there, you do, for example, as we know, make pharmaceuticals in Ireland and ship them all over the world, including the US, then the threat is tariffs. It's a threat at the moment. Will it be implemented? We don't know yet, but that's the discourse.
Now, just remind us about our own corporation tax and what has been collected, say, in the most recent Exchequer returns, minus maybe the Apple windfall that we got. Take us through just how important they are to us.
Yeah, we're up on a kind of annual level of $30 billion at this stage. When you look at the state budget, which is $100 billion, like, that's one third of everything the government spends comes from corporation tax. And when we say corporation tax, it's really multinationals. They dwarf anyone else, any other company in Ireland. We have champions like Kerry Group and CRH and all that. They don't even feature when you look what they pay in corporation tax in Ireland compared to Microsoft or Pfizer. So that's why the US aspect is so important. All those companies are headquartered in the US. They only have their tax arrangements through Ireland, because the US law allows them to do that. And that's been a very long-standing policy of the US to just say, go abroad, do business as American companies around the world, and do get whatever tax arrangements you can get there, and we won't be too hard on you coming back. And that's what is now being questioned by Trump, and it's very hard to see exactly where it's going to land.
Now, we hear a lot of talk from the agencies in Ireland and indeed government ministers saying that, look, people, multinationals are not just here for the corporation tax, they're here for the talent pool, we're, you know, a good place to do business. But what's your assessment? Like, how dangerous is this for us? Or is there a particular sector that you think we should be more scared about than the other?
Yeah, there's definitely a number of factors when multinationals decide where to install an office, a factory, and to base taxable profits. And they need to tick as many boxes as they can. So having a good, educated, English-speaking workforce with the good skills, that's one. Having renewable energy and good electricity connections for data centers, that's another one. Or for pharma factories, if you're in that business, that's another one. And then when they have all that ticked, the next one is, how much tax are we going to pay? Or sometimes, before they have all those boxes ticked, the tax comes in because it's going to be such a big part of that particular business. And unless you have them all, you're not going to get the investment. What Trump is trying to do is to get them all. He's promising very fast approval to build power plants if you want big data centers for AI. He's promising low tax. He's promising that, you know, it's going to be easy to get planning permission, things like that. And that's where there's competition with Ireland, not just the tax. That's true. Then, yeah, I suppose the sectors you mentioned, which ones? Pharma is number one because it's actual factories. So there's good and bad in that. Because it is goods being shipped, that's where tariffs can come in, and that's the threat. Because it's bricks and mortar, it's also harder to move. So when you've invested billions and billions, like, you know, AbbVie and Pfizer and all those MSDs have done in Ireland, you're not going to really demolish it or try to sell it to someone else who is going to buy it. It's very, very expensive. And just do something else elsewhere. You've done those investments over a number of years ahead with a very strict plan. So a tax change wouldn't necessarily question the whole edifice. And that was probably factored in at some point, that risk was there. Mm. Then the real risk is for the new ones. Like, if somebody today in somewhere in the US is saying, where I'm going to build my next factory or my next data center, that's where the factors are changing and people are going to make decisions based on what is actually decided this year, because a lot is happening this year in the US on tax and trade policy.
Mm. And if you were advising the agencies or government about how they can, you know, continue to compete, because that's what really it is continuing to compete. We have some problems of our own domestically. I see IBEC calling it out this week that before we ever touch the corporation tax, you mentioned there, we have got to have energy. We've got to have a deregulation period, I suppose, to free things up. If you were advising government now, what would you say? This is what you need to do to change things, to maybe go out into the world and continue to compete, because that's what it is. We're now competing.
Yeah, there's various ideas. Obviously, the various of the boxes that need to be ticked, we mentioned earlier, is planning, energy, infrastructure, that needs to be there. That's in some areas, it's actually a harder hurdle for companies to come to Ireland than any change in tax that might be coming down the line. Then there's how you deal with the Trump administration. Is it going to be, you know, confrontational? Is it going to be just hide behind the EU and do whatever Brussels does? Or is it going to be the usual kind of clever Irish moves? We find allies in Congress who are of Irish descent, who are close to Trump. Can we get in a word for Ireland? Can we explain where we stand? Can we cut those deals that Trump wants to cut in terms of who is going to buy gas from America? All those aspects that he wants to show his winning markets elsewhere. Are we going to be able to maybe give on some areas and take on others and make those kind of transactional decisions with Trump that he really likes, that he can show he's done something that is beneficial for his voters? That's also a very big part of the equation.
Yeah, people often mention, you know, he's transactional, and that's a bad thing. But there's another side to being transactional. If you've got something to negotiate with him on, you can use that to your advantage. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was your assessment of the EU. You kind of touched on it there a moment ago. It's whether or not we continue as part of that big bloc that may or may not get caught into a trade war with him on that and other issues, or where member states start to sort of go it alone and cut those individual deals with us. Based on what you've seen in recent months with the new commission, Ursula von der Leyen, the Draghi report, do you think that Europe are ready, unified and able to keep the bloc together and not stop countries like Ireland or Germany going off and doing their own individual deals, which could ultimately undermine things for them?
There depends on what aspect of that relationship with the US you're looking at. So there are things where the EU is definitely better, like trade negotiations, tariffs, trade wars. There's no point in Ireland trying to go it alone. For one thing, it's illegal. So trying to impose a tariff on US goods because we don't like what they're doing.
But could we go off and say we're going to import a load of LNG from the US?
And that's totally possible. And, you know, that's where there is more leeway. And another area where Ireland can do more maybe is in how it deals with companies in a practical sense. So the law, for example, under the OECD deal is set at EU level. There is a directive that says 15% for all the big multinationals. Nobody's going to change that unless it happens at EU level. But what Ireland can do is when the company starts to file those returns, it's going to be a huge burden, even for a big multinational, that they're going to have to prove every euro or dollar that moves between Ireland and other countries, and that ultimately it comes up to 15%. Can we make it easy for them? Can we convince them that Ireland is the best place to do this in terms of not being at risk of being sued, that you didn't get it right? All those guarantees, that kind of, you know, red tape aspect of it and risk, can it be safer to do in Ireland and easier, considering you're going to pay the same tax rate everywhere anyway? Mm. And Ireland's been good at that in the past, so you can do it in the new world as well.
Thomas, it's a fascinating issue, and this landscape is going to be changing very quickly, as we've seen in 1 week. A lot of those executive orders having multiple consequences for many, many businesses here in Ireland. But for today, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Thomas Hubert, editor with The Currency. Thank you very much for coming into us.
Thanks, Mandy.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. And for me, it's a particularly special one as it's my last time presenting this show. It's been an incredible 3 years. I've loved absolutely every single moment of bringing the stories, the insights and the discussions that shape our world. I have been very grateful for the opportunity to grow the show to an unbelievable 80,000 listeners every Sunday morning. So a big thank you to everyone who's tuned in. You've truly been at the heart of everything that we all do here on this show. Your support and kind comments over the years have made this an incredibly positive and rewarding experience for me personally. And of course, a programme like this doesn't happen without an amazing team behind the scenes. So a huge thank you to John Fardy, the series producer of Taking Stock. He's taught me a lot about radio and way too much about Billy Joel and Everton Football Club. So my thanks to him. My thanks also to Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt for their outstanding research, and especially to Simon, who was with me in the early days and was very patient when I hadn't a clue what I was doing. My thanks also to Hugo De Silva Scott on sound for keeping me sounding professional every week. I'd also like to thank the remarkable guests that we've been very privileged to host both here in Ireland and from across the globe for sharing their expertise and perspectives and, most importantly, giving us their very valuable time. A final special thanks to my husband Brendan and sister Jennifer. I could always count on having at least two loyal listeners every week. And while I'm saying goodbye to Taking Stock for now, I'm not saying goodbye to News Talk. I'll be back on the air in future and I look forward to being back with you again soon. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.